From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, US lawmakers unveil a $1 trillion plus bill to fund the government until October.
It's like $15 million a year for an office that's totally unnecessary to protect the catfish farmers. Pork barreling seems to be back in vogue.
Also today, Chris Christie's State of the State address, overshadowed by several scandals circling the New Jersey governor. French President Francois Hollande comes face to face with the press over his alleged affair. And also today, the UN's concern over renewed fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo just a month after a peace agreement was signed.
151 children, including babies caught in crossfire, were killed or maimed as a result of conflict-related violence.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Obama administration has hit back at comments reportedly made by Israel's defense minister, who called Secretary of State John Kerry, quote, messianic in his quest for Middle East peace. The State Department called the comments offensive and inappropriate. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
An Israeli newspaper says Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon accused John Kerry of having an unfathomable obsession and a messianic feeling about the Middle East peace process. The only thing that could save Israel, he said, would be if Mr. Kerry won a Nobel Peace Prize and then, in his words, leaves us alone. The State Department has hit back, saying Mr. Kerry is working night and day to promote a secure peace for Israel, and saying that if accurately quoted, the defense minister's remarks are offensive, inappropriate, and not something we would expect from a senior Israeli cabinet minister.
Millions of Egyptians have begun voting in the first of a two-day referendum on a new constitution that could lead to fresh elections. The new constitution would replace the one passed under the Islamist president Mohamed Morsi, who was removed from office by the country's military. Military leaders are hoping for a strong vote in favor of the new constitution to endorse Morsi's removal. But the Muslim Brotherhood, the party of Mr. Morsi, is boycotting the vote and several have died during clashes. Our correspondent Kat Stapley is at one of the polling stations in North Cairo.
Security here is very tight. It's very tight across the whole country today. There's 160,000 army personnel along with 200,000 police. They're all securing 30,000 polling stations across the country. Now, here at this polling station, there are army and police securing the entrance, and there's an army sniper on the roof above me here, because the last thing the authorities want is anyone winning this vote, which is what the Muslim Brotherhood have been threatening to do.
Members of the U.S. Congress are beginning the process to approve a $1 trillion budget aimed at avoiding another government shutdown in the United States. The spending plan, agreed by House and Senate negotiators, will finance the government until October. Kate Fisher has more.
The bipartisan bill released last night will finally put to rest the budget battles of last year. The 1,500-page legislation would increase military spending and undo some cuts to veterans' benefits, but it will slash funding for the IRS, public health programs, and high-speed rail. There are also policy riders to prevent the government from making certain environmental and labour regulations. Republican and Democratic leaders say they believe they will get majorities in the House and Senate to pass the bill, but not without loud protests from both the right and the left. The bill will come up for a vote later this week.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. 27 Nobel laureates, together with the British actor Ian McKellen, have addressed Russian President Vladimir Putin in an open letter urging him to scrap the so-called gay propaganda law introduced in Russia last year that gay rights activists say is discriminatory. Confusion remains over how exactly the law will be implemented during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. The Mexican government has sent security forces to the western state of Michoacán in order to disarm local vigilante groups. These vigilante groups emerge as an effort to drive out members of a drug cartel known as the Knights Templar. Mexican military and the vigilantes clashed as soldiers tried to disarm the self-defense groups. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
The Mexican government sent troops to retake an area known as Tierra Caliente. This comes after days of violence have taken place between the Knights Templar cartel and the vigilantes. According to the vigilantes, the military opened fire on innocent civilians, allegedly killing four people, among them an 11-year-old girl. The Mexican Attorney General's office said that this information had not been confirmed. Vigilante spokesman Estanislao Beltrán said that the confrontation occurred near the town of Antunes early Tuesday. Beltrán added that they don't have any confidence in the government and that, according to this group, the government is compromised by the organized crime.
J.P. Morgan has recorded a drop in profits for the last quarter following the case of convicted fraudster Bernie Madoff. The decline in earnings is largely due to one-off payments in connection with the case. Purchases in the U.S. increased 0.2% in December, exceeding most economists' expectations. Excluding auto sales, consumer demand increased by the highest margin in almost a year. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Just days away from yet another government shutdown, lawmakers unveiled a more than $1 trillion plus bill to fund the government until October. The 1,500-page legislation would boost military spending, undo some cuts to veterans' benefits, and slash funding for the IRS, public health programs, and high-speed rail, among other targets. Also tucked into the massive bill, which will come up for a vote later this week, are policy riders to prevent the government from making certain environmental and labour regulations. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has the story.
The deal, made in backroom negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over the past few months, is expected to pass later this week, as lawmakers don't seem eager for the threat of yet another government shutdown. But some on the political left and right are speaking out against the deal. Arizona Republican John McCain praised the bill for restoring tens of billions of dollars to the Pentagon's budget, but said it wasn't done in a fiscally responsible way.
There's some pork in there that's really outrageous. We had denied funding for a bunch of pork for Guam. In the authorization, we had particularly prohibited it. They put that money in. It's like $15 million a year for an office. It's totally unnecessary to protect the catfish farmers. Unfortunately, pork barreling seems to be back in vogue.
McCain is also among many Congress members criticizing the budget's authorization of more than $1 billion in military aid to Egypt, which violates a decades-old U.S. law that forbids support for regimes that overthrow democratically elected governments.
They're about to approve of a constitution that basically carves out a unique place for the military. It is a constitution that is a constitution in name only as far as freedom is concerned. They keep arresting people and murdering people. We've got to exercise influence. We need to condition it seriously that they change their ways, but doesn't look like they're going to do that.
The bill introduced Monday night puts only two conditions on the money for Egypt: that the government sustain a strategic relationship with the United States and that it abide by its peace treaty with Israel. There are no criteria concerning human rights, press freedom, or free and fair elections. Independent experts, including Robert Nayman with Just Foreign Policy, are also voicing concern about the impact this decision could have around the world.
Every country that receives U.S. aid, you know, where there might be people in the military that might think it was kind of cool to overthrow the government, they're going to see this. The message here is, as long as we do what the U.S. wants on the military side, we can do whatever we want in terms of democracy. And if U.S. officials say, no, 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 that's just for Egypt, that's not for you, people in these countries, you know, in their militaries, are likely to think, well, you know, you say that, but you're not going to back that up.
Others are raising concerns about what the budget does not fund, either fully or at all. The Prevention and Public Health Fund in the Affordable Care Act was cut by $1 billion, and funds were eliminated for high-speed rail, the International Monetary Fund, and the United Nations Organization for Education, Science, and Culture. The bill also explicitly bans funding to ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, even though that group ceased to exist in 2010. The bill also cuts $500 million from the budget of the IRS. Editor Lee Shepard with the tax policy journal Tax Notes says the agency has recently become sort of a political punching bag, but it's regular taxpayers who pay the price.
Congress constantly asks the IRS to do things, and then they don't want to pay for it. And then if the IRS, you know, screws up at something, Congress knows that Congress will not be blamed. The IRS will be vilified. And so, you know, Congress will cut the IRS's budget, and they cut. And then, you know, the phone service will be bad or something like that, that regular people notice, because there's not enough money and not enough people.
Shepard noted that the IRS will have an even heavier workload in the coming year as the Affordable Care Act goes into effect, since it will be in charge of verifying the income of millions of Americans to determine their eligibility for health care subsidies. Despite these and other concerns, the entire 1,500-page bill is expected to pass the House and Senate this weekend. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Chris Christie's State of the State address today was overshadowed, unsurprisingly perhaps, by the scandals circling the embattled New Jersey governor, already facing a probe into the role his staff played in the gridlock caused at the country's busiest bridge in September. The governor is now being investigated by a federal watchdog over the use of Hurricane Sandy relief funds for a Jersey tourism ad campaign featuring him and his family.
Jersey Shore is open.
The word is spreading.
Because we're stronger than the storm.
You bet we are.
For a look at what these revelations mean for Chris Christie's political reputation, I spoke to correspondent for the New York Daily News, Dan Friedman.
It's being overshadowed and will be overshadowed by the ongoing Bridgegate scandal, and which is giving way to various investigations into other allegations of improper use of state resources for political purposes by Christie's administration.
But it's not just going to be Bridgegate that overshadows Christie's event this afternoon. There's also the scandal surrounding advertising regarding relief funds from Hurricane Sandy.
That's right. I think people are asking, they're looking at this and they're saying, well, this can't have been an isolated incident. There must have been, was, or must have been part of a culture of Christie's aides and people he appointed engaging in really aggressive efforts to politicize everything the state does. And one issue that's been around for a while and now is getting new attention is these ads for Hurricane Sandy, the Stronger Than the Storm campaign that New Jersey ran, which featured pictures of Christie and his family. This is while he's running for re-election. And at the time, people said, wow, doesn't this seem kind of political? And Senator Rand Paul, who may run against Christie for the Republican nomination in 2016, criticized it. And now the Inspector General for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which oversees a lot of the Sandy money, says it's auditing the spending, the $25 million that they spent, which came from HUD, on those ads.
These recent events, is this an unraveling for Chris Christie's potential run at the White House 2016, do you think?
It's potentially an unraveling. He's not dead, but it raises this question of whether at least, it's clear that at least people who worked for him were, if not incompetent, aggressively political and engaged in unprofessional conduct, I think, in the eyes of many Americans and New Jerseyans. And so he needs to find a way to say, that's not me, which is what he was trying to do in his press conference last week, to say that this is somehow foreign to who I am. But it certainly makes it very difficult for him when we continue to see, for example, the mayor of Jersey City said he was retaliated against for not endorsing Christie as well now. So it goes against sort of his core argument that he's this bipartisan, no-nonsense, apolitical guy who just wants to get stuff done. And certainly if he obviously was implicated in this at all, that would be the end of his campaign. On the other hand, you know, it is possible that he'll sort of come up with a way to talk about this that'll allow him to still be a viable candidate, at least for the Republican nomination.
And he's always been a divisive figure in his own party. But, I mean, how has this recent spate of incidents gone down with his standing within the GOP?
I think that, as you mentioned, there's conservatives in the Republican Party who don't like him. Obviously, Rand Paul is one of them. and particularly because of his embrace of Obama after Hurricane Sandy, literal embrace of Obama and figurative embrace of Obama, which many people felt helped President Obama get reelected. And I think a lot of Republicans felt Christie was helping himself at the expense of the Republican Party by also trying to appeal like a bipartisan guy. With those people already don't like him, but I think the independents and the moderate Republicans who would be his natural base if he was running for the nomination now may say, well, who is this guy? He is not this person that we thought he was. Maybe we should look at another potential Republican candidate like Marco Rubio or someone who is a little less tainted, I think, is the danger for Christie.
Correspondent for the New York Daily News, Dan Friedman. Now, Egyptians have been turning out to vote on a new constitution following the overthrow of the first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. The military rulers are confident of a strong yes vote, with the opposition Muslim Brotherhood boycotting the ballot following the arrest of Islamist campaigners. Cairo-based correspondent Bel True told me that voting began amid violent scenes.
Well, before the polling stations even opened at about 7 o'clock this morning, a bomb blast ripped through a North Cairo criminal court, pulling down all the windows of all the buildings in the surrounding area. People were expecting this kind of flashes of violence and possible terror attacks because of the nature of the situation surrounding the constitutional referendum. It has been quite a difficult few months for Egypt, and there are a significant group of people who are against the process of the constitution and the referendum, and of course the military, the military's roadmap for the future of Egypt. So people were quite tense this morning. The streets were covered in security forces. Polling stations were protected by police and army, and we had helicopters in the sky.
Can you remind us how this referendum came about and ultimately who stands to gain from today's vote?
Well, the referendum is on an amended version of the 2012 constitution, which was initially penned by the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, in 2012. Now, the reason that we are now back at the polling stations a year later, looking at Egypt's possibly third constitution in as many years, is because the military generals overthrew the Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, in July after nationwide protests calling for his ouster. Since then, his administration's been thrown out. His constitution was redrafted. He himself is on trial, and his group was declared, the Muslim Brotherhood was declared a terrorist organization on Christmas Day. Since July, there's been a concerted effort by the government to crack down on the Islamist supporters of Mohamed Morsi, and even recently on secular activists expressing dissent to the way the government in the country is going. So the background of this constitution is one of violence and political tumult. In terms of who stands to gain if it does get ratified, well, I think the biggest winners would be Egypt's military.
And the military obviously chasing that strong yes vote, as you said, but has there been any sort of tangible opposition movement, vote no movement?
Well, this is really something that's very telling about the situation that we're in here. There's always been a lively debate over whatever election is taking place, and that's meant to be invisible at the moment. There was a no campaign that one Egyptian party called the Strong Egypt Party, that's a moderate Islamist party, and actually backed the military generals initially when they overthrew Morsi. They had started a tentative no to the constitution campaign and attempted to put up posters. Well, six of their members are actually in jail at the moment. They were arrested when they put those posters up. According to human rights lawyers that I spoke to, they were arrested because they were challenging the current constitution, and this has seemed to be illegal. So they were really the sole voice of no in terms of sort of political parties here in Egypt.
And important to mention, worrying times if you're an international journalist in Egypt.
Well, this is something that has really worried international journalists covering Egypt at the moment, is the detentions of the three Al Jazeera English reporters, including an award-winning Australian reporter, Peter Grist, and also a Canadian former CNN employee, Mohamed Fahmy. Now, these three are being kept in prison despite no formal charges being actually held against them. These three are really being treated in a quite an exceptionally harsh manner. Now, the authorities say that they have been arrested because they had no accreditation, and certainly I don't think Al Jazeera had organised their accreditation properly, but that is more of an administrative error, not a crime.
And the charges that they're being investigated for include joining a terrorist organization, which is significantly more dramatic than someone not having a press card.
Cairo-based correspondent Bell True. The United Nations has expressed its concern about renewed fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo, just 1 month after a peace agreement was signed. The UN's mission in the country, its largest peacekeeping force anywhere in the world, helped to bring about an end to the hostilities. But atrocities like the rape and execution of children are continuing to dog the country, and other rebel groups are now threatening the country's fragile peace. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations headquarters in New York.
Last year in the Democratic Republic of Congo, aggression turned to agreement as the M23 laid down their arms and promised peace. But things have already started to slide with attacks from other militia groups. Briefing the UN Security Council, the head of MONUSCO, the UN mission in the DRC, Martin Kobler, said renewed efforts were needed as December's optimism had given way to a sense of fragility.
We have made clear that there would be no cohabitation with armed groups, any of them. Our position is clear. We are not in the DRC to react, but to act. We are not there only to deter, but to prevent. And we do not only keep the peace, we must make peace a long-term reality.
Briefing via video phone from DRC's capital, Kinshasa, the UN Special Envoy Mary Robinson spoke of the change since December's peace agreement.
The reality today is that the positive atmosphere that then prevailed has vanished. What is most important for meaningful progress is the immediate implementation of all commitments at the national and regional levels in order to bring about concrete peace dividends and lasting life improvement to the people in the region.
But atrocities are continuing. Kobler said that UN officials had gathered reports of shocking crimes against civilians and children.
In 2013, 151 children, including babies caught in crossfire and primary school students summarily executed, were killed or maimed as a result of conflict-related violence. 260 underage girls were documented by MONUSCO as having been raped by parties to the conflict. This is only the tip of the iceberg. Their childhood is destroyed, their future is brutally burdened, and we cannot remain and should not remain silent and passive.
Enemy behind the bush!
Enemy behind the bush!
Last year, the UN Security Council agreed to send a 3,000-strong intervention brigade to the DRC. African soldiers with the unprecedented mandate to engage the rebel groups. Their work, along with the Congolese army, helped bring about the peace agreement last month between the government and the M23 movement. Some 8,000 M23 fighters have already surrendered to the Congolese army, the FARDC, and been given aid by the UN to help them back into society. The UN's Major Walid Turki has been helping ex-combatants in the eastern town of Goma, around where much of the recent fighting has been concentrated.
We're doing a resettlement and reintegration for them here, and encourages ex-combatants to surrender to FRDC, to DDR, to become civilian, because our task here to protect the civilians and to make a stabilization for Congo.
The UN mission says it now needs closer cooperation with the Congolese government to combat this period of renewed turbulence. Martin Kobler made it clear that this year the UN mission in the DRC must adapt to meet these new challenges. He said by July, two-thirds of its peacekeepers will have been redeployed to the troubled east of the country to fight the numerous new rebel groups and prevent the re-emergence of the M23. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
Les affaires privées se traitent en privé, dans une intimité respectueuse de chacun. Ce n'est donc ni le lieu ni le moment de le faire. Mais si je ne répondrai...
The French president François Hollande telling a press conference that it was neither the time nor the place to answer questions about his personal life and that private matters should be dealt with privately. He said he would not be drawn on the reports of an affair with an actress out of respect for those involved. The news conference, a long-planned event aimed at unveiling policies to help France's struggling economy, was the president's first public appearance since the allegations were published. He's due to come to the US next month to meet President Obama. It's not clear who will be accompanying him as First Lady, but told reporters it would be clarified by then. Journalist Fiacre Gibbons was at the press conference, and he told FSN's Kate Fisher that there was a tense atmosphere.
Beforehand, there was a huge amount of tension, as you can imagine, amazing amount of anticipation, because the question on everybody's lips was who was going to ask where the president now stands in this love triangle, if you like, or love square, if you include his the mother of his four children, his ex, Ségolène Royal, into the equation, because she never really goes away. It failed to a French journalist who's the president of the Association of the Correspondents at the Élysée, who's from the Figaro newspaper, to ask the question. Lots of people were afraid that he wouldn't ask anything about the president's private life, because in the past, people generally didn't. It was seen as not done. And he did ask the question in Hollande, in a typical Hollande way. He answered it and said, on principle, I will not talk about my private life. And then said that he would resolve this problem by the time that he goes to America to see Obama on the 11th of February. So we both said, I will not talk about it, and that I will talk about it at the same time, which is very Hollande, looking one way and the other at the same time. So I think there will be a question, there will be a response to whether the France will have a First Lady, and who that First Lady will be within the next month.
It's also quite extraordinary that this man is essentially telling the world that he's going to choose between his two lovers, if you like, before he heads off to America.
That's true. It is quite bizarre. I mean, it is a very, very bizarre situation, but it's in France, we have this idea called le jardin secret. Everybody has a right to a secret garden, which is, both men and women would say this, which is this part of themselves that is secret. It's their private life. It's what they do, what their dreams, their desires, and what they do about that. That has kind of melded into this reverential attitude towards the presidency, because the president is really an elected king in France. And so you've got all this hangover from the ancien regime of this, of the king who is unquestioned. So there's a kind of fear also about posing very difficult questions, particularly among the press corps. This is a massive difference to the US or Britain. Generally, if correspondents at the Élysée ask difficult questions, they're never allowed almost to ask questions again.
So we wait with bated breath to find out which lady he brings to America next month.
Indeed.
And while almost nobody was watching, he actually made some really big policy announcements today.
In the build-up to this, all the coverage, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, was on the scandal and how it would possibly undermine him before this key moment. In fact, the State of the Union address is almost the French equivalent of it. And in fact, what he's done, the actual body of the press conference, is he's actually driven a coach and horses through a large part of the French social state. He's given employers a huge break in paying social charges, in a tax break in a way. This was unthinkable even for Sarkozy to do. And he's also going to push through, he said, 50 billion in cuts in the next 3 years. If you add this to the 15 billion they're already making next year, that's really 65 billion, which is a massive cut in French public spending. And this is a socialist president who's doing it. So while everyone's watching the actress and everyone's obsessed with the affair, he's actually completely changing a lot of the ways that French people do business. He may have pulled off something here, weirdly. While people are looking one way, he's done something quite kind of daring for a left-wing president.
Fiacre Gibbons in Paris, talking with FSN's Kate Fisher. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.